You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with someone I've actually just recently met, but he's an interesting fellow. His name is, well, now do I call you Dr. Owner Yenigan, or can I call you Owner Yenigan or Owner? But he is formerly, if you meet him on the street, this is Dr. Owner Yenigan, and he is a medical doctor, and among many other things. So let's start with those many other things. And thank you first for being willing to come on and talk about what you do and what your life is like and insights you have had from that. And
sure.
And wait, actually, first I want to ask a question that maybe I shouldn't even ask, and maybe I'll just take this out, which is like, how old are you?
I'm 37 years old.
37 years old. So you've accomplished a lot in a short period of time. So,
well, thank you.
Oh, so, yeah. Well, right. Yeah. So,
it doesn't feel like a short period of time.
I know. Yeah. Just wait. You just
great.
Don't even start. It's like,
all right. Yes, sir.
I look in the mirror sometimes like, wait, how did this happen? You know, but I still feel like a kid. What do you mean?
So, I love it.
So, okay. So, You're a bunch of different things and a bunch of different, I think from the outside looking in, people would say, well, you're a bunch of different identities. So your mom and your dad both came from Turkey to the United States.
Correct.
And you were born here and raised here. But did you feel like you were sort of straddling two different worlds? Because they were an immigrant family, or did they assimilate right away? And because I know you speak Turkish as well as English, but
yeah, it's a bit tough question to answer. I mean, they were, you know, they did immigrate here, first generation here. My childhood was so kind of tumultuous that it was really hard to really grasp any identity. You know, my dad left when I was three, so it was really my mom raising me, but right. She had a tough time. So my grandmother moved in with us, who only speaks Turkish and is very Turkish. So I learned a lot of values and culture from her. And then a lot of my younger formative years I spent with babysitters as well. So I got to, you know, experience many, many different cultures and people and religions as well. I've been to many different types of churches. So I've been exposed to so much. So it's really hard to grasp a true identity at a young age.
That's interesting. So your grandmother who raised you, she spoke Turkish. She was very Turkish, whatever that. And was she Muslim?
yes.
Yeah. And were you raised in a particular religion? Were you raised to be, or do you identify as a Muslim? Do you identify in other ways or?
No, I'm not really religious in that sense. No, I mean, my grandmother never pushed a religion on me. You know, she would always, you know, talk about here and there, talk about God and Allah and all that stuff, but she never had me pray. She never had me do any of that stuff. Just really, I think she just wanted to instill some good values in me and use religion as a means of doing that in some sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And you went back to visit your dad when you were a kid, or you grew up and went back to visit your dad?
I didn't really speak to my dad from when I was age three until I was 19.
So
he found me.
Wow. Was that a surprise? Like, who the hell are you? What do you want? Or what? Like,
it really was. It was actually when I was in the military, and I got a phone call saying from my commandant saying, come to my office. Your dad's on the phone. So.
Wow, man. That is really wild. Do you remember the moment? I mean, was it like, wow, that's great? Or was like, what the hell is this?
part of that's a blur. I do remember when I actually like first met him, though. We met in a hotel in Claremont, California. And it was pretty surreal, you know, seeing my dad for the first time since I was three. Because the only really memory from childhood I have is for some reason being in a ball pit at Chuck E. Cheese and him throwing me into it. Besides that, I had nothing. So it was quite the difference.
Okay, so you grew up mostly in California, moving around in California for the most part. Yeah.
Yes, and bounced around a lot between northern and southern.
Okay, and I know we spoke about this before, but I think it's an interesting trajectory, right? So then, how did you make it to med school? Med school was not first. First, you went into the military. And was that a plan from the start? You know, like when I grow up, I want to be a military person or talk about that.
Yeah. On the contrary, it was actually, I knew that I wanted to be a doctor. When I was young, I was living with my aunt and uncle, and my mom was having a pretty tough time, you know, not being able to be with her son all the time. And it put her into a pretty dark place. And I wanted to be in some way useful. I used to watch that TV show ER a lot with George Clooney. I don't know if you ever remember it.
Oh, yes.
But my mother's like the twin of one of the nurses on that show.
Oh,
and
wow.
I remember calling my mom in fourth grade and saying, "Mom, I want you to be happy. You should be a nurse because they're happy on TV." And, you know, she was obviously tough to convince, but I eventually did. So I moved back in, and, you know, fifth and sixth grade every night, I would study with her, translate nursing books into Turkish. You know, we'd make flashcards, and I found it so fascinating, you know, reading as a fifth grader how when I scrape my knee, it stops bleeding. But also my mom got, you know, she started out as a CNA, and I just saw her find so much happiness and joy in helping others, and realized that not only medicine was cool, but it kind of saved my mom. And that's when I really started to fall in love with it.
She became a nurse.
Oh, she climbed the ladder my whole life. I mean, she started as a CNA, became a medical assistant, became an LVN. It was actually my third year of medical school. I got to leave the operating room. I was on a surgery rotation and go help pin her as a nurse in her RN ceremony. Next year, she got to hood me as a doctor. So it's kind of been our journey together my whole life.
That's pretty fabulous. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
So, but before that came the military.
Yes, yes.
What was that about? What was that? Where did that come from? Was it? I mean, like you kind of pointed at it, but
yeah, you know, I knew what I wanted to do in my life, but I was not the prototypical kid that becomes a doctor. You know, come from an immigrant family. You know, no father figure in my life. We were on welfare and food stamps growing up. You know, I was not the kid that goes and just becomes a doctor. And I think I had a lot of issues in believing in myself and believing that I could accomplish that mission. And I kind of decided that maybe this would be a good way for me to prove to myself that I could accomplish something challenging. You know, I finished high school when I was 15. Not because I was a super smart student. I mean, I had no discipline. I was terrible at doing homework. I mean, I was great at taking tests, but I didn't have any real discipline, you know, and I felt like I was getting into trouble a bit. And I met a recruiter on campus, and, you know, I said, "Hey, you know, I want to do this." And he took me into his office. They had me take the entrance test, and they said, "You could be a nuclear engineer." And I said, "No, just give me the hardest job you have. Like, my goal is to go in there and get my butt kicked and come out a different person." And that's what I did. So, you know, I'd only done one semester of community college before I joined the Marine Corps, and I did absolutely terrible. You know, I had C's, withdrawals. I had one A in Taekwondo, which I'm sure was a pity A, as I believe I told you in the past. But when I got out and I came back, I went to that same community college, and I had nothing but straight A's. So it definitely was a transformative experience. Well, no, I went in at 18. So I worked for a few years and helped, you know, helped support the home. I worked at a furniture store, actually. Did that for a while, and then decided to hop into the Corps.
Yeah. Okay, so you went to the Marine Corps, and you got stationed where? All around?
Yeah, I was at Camp Pendleton here in Southern California. Was at sea for a while, Japan, Philippines, all over, really.
Did you get sent to places where there's combat?
I wasn't truly in a combat zone, even though I was in an infantry unit, interestingly enough. But, you know, we had some tough moments, definitely.
Did you want that? I mean, were you like at that age where you were like, give me action, give me something, let me prove myself?
I was prepared for it. I don't think anyone truly, you know, wants to go into a situation where you're going to have to hurt others or potentially hurt yourself or potentially lose the lives of your brothers and sisters that you're serving next to. But I was definitely ready for it. And I did see it as a potential challenge that would have helped me grow. But I think I got enough. I got more than what I needed out of my service. And, you know, I'm proud of everyone I served with.
And was it, so the whole time you're there, it's still in your mind that you want to be a doctor or no?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it was. It was always in the back of my mind. Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So
sure.
Does one of those, for lack of a better term, identities, roles, whether it's a kid who is Turkish ethnically, a kid who was raised by a single mom, a Marine, off to medical school, a doctor, like does one of them, like do you sit in one of those in a bigger way? Like, do you feel like one of those has made you are first and foremost a, but does one of those stand out as primary?
I think one of the biggest things I do identify is as a veteran.
You
know, I get to work with veterans often now. It's a close community for me. It means a lot. And it was able to take all the, you know, I was able to take all the challenges and everything in my childhood and my upbringing and just kind of throw it all into that and transform it into something that's made me a lot stronger. And I think that was able to, you know, that's what made me able to do all that. So I think that is a big part of my identity, but so is, you know, being first generation in this country. It's not easy, you know. So is being raised by a single mother. It's not easy for me, nor was it for her. And that all, I value all those things, and I value those challenges and the adversity. But I think the thing now that if I was to, you know, lay back on it would be that I'm a veteran, because that really lifts me up and makes me feel that I can do a lot more than I ever thought I could.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I sort of was imagining that you, most of my pals, most of my buddies, one way or another, who have been in military service, there's something about that experience that it's almost like, you get into the fires together. And I don't necessarily mean active, you know, people shooting at you, but you get into the cauldron. And it somehow creates this special thing that when you bump into one, there it is. It pulls that out, and so it's interesting. Okay, so then you went to be a doctor, but it's not just a doctor. You're an emergency room doctor, and that is a unique. Yeah. I mean, I get they all are, right? Sure, a brain surgeon is or whatever. But it's not family practice. You're not sitting in the office all day, you know, next patient.
I don't think I could. I don't think I could.
Well, Sam, what do you mean? Too boring?
I mean, you know, I don't know. When I was in medical school, you know, we rotated everything. You know, we try it all out. So, you know, it's right for you. And then family practice, I just couldn't do. I mean, when you show up and you have a schedule, you know, at 6 o'clock, it's a cough. At 7 o'clock, it's a physical. And 8 o'clock, so I have a headache. It's just that the day felt too scripted for me. And, you know, I couldn't do it. It's one of the things I love about emergency medicine is how unpredictable it is. Mm. You never know what's coming, you know? You have no idea what's walking through the door. And it's one of the few fields in medicine where our patients are undifferentiated, right? I mean, you go to see a neurologist is typically because you have a migraine or, you know, you have some type of neurological disorder. You go to see a pulmonologist because, you know, you have cystic fibrosis or a pneumonia that won't go away or something. But in the ER, you're coming because you have this lingering cough or you have this odd chest pain or this new swelling or mass in your leg. So there's a puzzle aspect to it that I truly love. The unpredictability I truly love. And it's a lot like the Marine Corps in a sense that you in one moment are taking care of somebody that, you know, stitching up their finger, and next moment the paramedics call in and say, hey, in 3 minutes we're coming in with someone that's shot 3 times in the chest, and you have to take this emergency department full of nurses and techs and everybody else and turn into this well-oiled machine, and boom, we're all ready to go in there and save a life. And it's so much like the Marine Corps. You have to snap together. You have to make difficult decisions in just moments, and it's a high pressure situation. So I felt like it was also one of the fields where I could apply everything that I learned in my service mm-hmm. and put it into something useful.
And you had told me that for a time you worked at Cedars, but then specifically worked elsewhere, right? I mean, chose someplace that was I don't know what to call it. You know, I don't know if it's less resourced or it certainly gets a different clientele in. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Cedars was a great place, but where I'm working now, it's definitely a ton of trauma. We have a large homeless population that has very poor access to primary care. We just see so many sick patients, and our numbers of patients we see a day are through the roof. And it's just a real good chance to make an impact in the community. Not that I wasn't overseas, but they're an amazing hospital, bunch of brilliant doctors. But here, I feel like a lot of times really am like on my own sometimes doing what I can to make a difference. And I feel like that's where I belong. That's where I can handle that. I love that.
And just to paint the picture, you know, how many doctors are in the emergency room at one time? Obviously there's extraordinary situations, but is it one? Is it two? Is it, you know, is the whole team of them?
There's two of us on at a time at this hospital. I also work out in Bakersfield in the Central Valley sometimes, and there I'm the only doctor for the ER and actually the only one in the hospital, and I work nights there. So if something happens, you know, on the third floor, I'm running up with a nurse and a tech to go up there and handle the situation. So both situations are quite challenging, but it's helped me grow so much. Well, and I appreciate that.
So in Bakersfield, you're sometimes the only doctor in the hospital, small hospital, I take it, but still, that means an enormous variety of things can come your way, some of which you probably don't have a lot of experience in. Yeah?
yeah.
What do you
do? I mean, that's why emergency medicine is what it is. I mean, that's why we always work so hard to get a little bit of knowledge and everything. That's why our residency training is like drinking from a fire hose. I mean, you'll spend a month delivering babies, and then you spend a month, you know, in surgery, and then, you know, you spend a month doing orthopedics. And that's why it is what it is, because it's just, you never know what's going to show up.
And how long is the residency to become an emergency?
It varies, but it's 3 to 4 years. A lot of programs are moving to 4 years. My program was 4 years at Stanford, but that's more common now.
Okay, so you also made mention of, did I get this right? Did you become a doctor at the beginning of COVID, or was it something like that where you and COVID overlapped in a significant way?
Yeah, COVID got me good. when COVID was really kicking off, I was actually in my final year of residency. And so it was a real challenge because, you know, we were having so many sick patients coming in, and our emergency department was getting flooded. And a lot of these patients, you know, since it's a respiratory disease, a lot of them were really crashing from that standpoint, and a lot of them needed intubation, which were, you know, put them to sleep and put a breathing tube in. And we ended up kind of making a policy where it was really just the most experienced people who would do the intubations. And at that point, it was us senior residents, you know, our small group of, I think it was 12 or 13 of us. So we were just always doing the intubations, and it just became, I mean, it was one, it's just so challenging because you're doing it over and over, and it's, the patients are so sick, but also kind of sad at times because family members couldn't come into the room before we did this, and they never know if they're going to see their family member again. Oh, wow. But it was just such a scary disease. You know, there were some moments where we were FaceTiming family members so they could at least, you know, give their well wishes or whatever they're going to say to their family members before we intubated them. So it was like a very emotional and hardly charged time in my training. But it was also fascinating. You know, the whole time in residency, our attendings were just teaching us things that they knew that we hadn't seen before. And this was the first time in our training where this was a new entity for all of us. Mm. So instead of them just teaching us, we were all learning together, you know? And I thought that was a really interesting way to end out my residency training.
And did you, I mean, it was a crazy time in the world, right? I mean, I think, yeah. You know, First, there was everybody stay, you know, distance yourself, stay away, right? Stay away from other breathing, living human beings. And then, now masks doesn't make sense because people were wearing masks. And then I was like, oh no, a mask makes sense. You have to wear a mask. And I mean, that whole thing going on. And then the idea of being, in the medical world at that time just seems crazy. Intense.
Yeah, it was. There was a lot of discussions and people asking questions over and over, and some that none of us knew the answers to yet, which was challenging. I think one of the biggest mistakes they made was just the term social distancing. I hated that term. You know, I think physical distancing, yes, but socially distancing yourself from people was one of the worst things you could absolutely do during a pandemic when you're already scared. People are locked in their homes. They don't have any human interaction. The socially distance makes no sense, right? Reach out to your loved ones. Talk to people. Do not feel alone. You may have to physically be alone, but the social distancing term, I think they could have changed maybe to something more like physical distancing. But I mean, because it had such an impact, right? People didn't think about this, but the amount of young children I saw coming into the emergency department was suicidality. The mental impact on children was insane. And you know, I didn't hear much about it, but the kids kept coming in just so depressed. Because think about it. I mean, especially for young kids, their social circle is what they have, right? They're not going to work every day. They don't have a job where they have to apply themselves to.
They're supposed to go to school, and which, you know, means staring at a screen, which was crazy, crazy, absurd, as if somehow that was, I mean, obviously there are some people who can do that, but.
That mental health aspect of it was tough, because to deal with all the patients, you know, like truly medically ill from that standpoint, from, you know, the respiratory stuff and everything else, to also have to deal with the impact on the children, it was pretty tough. And that's when they come into the emergency department, you know.
So tell me about that. So kids are depressed and their parents bring them into emergency because they're depressed.
A kid swallows a bottle of Tylenol because they want to harm themselves. The first place they're coming is to the emergency department. Yeah. You know, if a kid cuts themselves, they're coming to the emergency department. If a kid, you know, in the middle of the night, you know, your 8-year-old comes up to you and says, I really want to kill myself. Parents, they get scared. Where else are you going to, who are you going to call in the middle of the night? The only place you can go where you're going to see a doctor is the emergency department. So we deal with a lot of mental health. And during that, and with adults, you know, it's hard and it's very sad, but to see a child in that state is as challenging enough as it is. And to see it, so much of it then was even more so. Mm.
Do you have insight into how they could have handled it? They, meaning whoever it is that handles those things, not the doctors, not the frontline people, but the policymakers. Did you end up with an insight or at least ideas about how things might have been done in a way that was less negatively impactful on people?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough question, right? There's just so much to unpack there. You know, I do think that, I mean, the whole way that you even develop immunity, you know, the whole concept of herd immunity is that you have to have some of the herd exposed or at least vaccinated, right? And if you take college dorms, we have mostly really healthy young people, and you let them still stay in their college dorms when they can spread it amongst each other and start developing immunity, then maybe that's a good thing, right? If you lock up every single person into their home and never let anybody out, you develop zero immunity in your population, right? I mean, because it's not getting around. And then when you open the doors and let everyone back out, you're back at stage one, right? Where no one's immune. And especially early on when we had no vaccines, I mean, that's kind of our only option. And that could have been a way we handled it, but, you know, we didn't. And I'm sure we're learning from those mistakes.
I don't know the answer to this. Maybe there isn't an answer to this, but was the disease more deadly at first? I mean, it seems like over time, the variants, you know, as you folks, or at least the researchers, explain it, right? You know, the mutations sort of evolve so that they become more easily spread, but they don't necessarily kill their hosts because that's a bad plan. And
yeah, of course, yeah.
So over time,
it's evolution.
It would just seem like, you know, when I mean, I don't know if you saw them. I mean, I remember watching videos of people like literally just keeling over in the street. Like,
sure.
But it just seemed like if there was just a way, this is me speaking, right? Not with no expertise, but if there was just a way to have made it so that not everything, you know, we live at a wacky time, right? Everything's a political issue.
Yeah. Everything.
Like masks became a political issue.
Sure.
Masks, no masks.
Sure.
You know, it's as if you're making some sort of a statement. And early on, it just seemed like that was just the worst time to have the sidedness, the intense tribal sidedness about everything. You know, it's like I was crazy. So the idea of living through that and then, I mean, did policy change at the hospital? Like, as things were evolving? Like, first, everybody had to be vaccinated.
Policy definitely changed.
Yeah, it did?
Yeah. I mean, no, they were, essentially, if we weren't vaccinated, we were going to get let go. So it wasn't, vaccine was not an option. It was either you get it or you're fired. So
and did that feel that. Like, I mean, did that piss you off, or?
It was a little, I felt like it was a little harsh, a little abrasive, but it, you know, I mean, it was a vaccine that was so brand new, hadn't been tested a ton, but I get it. We're in the face of this global pandemic and the medical community is scared. I think it could have been worded better, definitely, you know. I mean, for the flu vaccine every year, it's, hey, you don't get it. Either you get it or you wear a mask at all times when you're in the emergency department. Cool, like, thank you, right? But with this, it was just so foot down. If you don't do it, you're gone.
You have to.
So I thought that was just a little abrasive, you know. But whatever. Initially we were all wearing masks 24/7 in the ER, no matter where you go, whatever. I mean, we couldn't even really like eat in the break room. It was insane. And then things, you know, and there was no visitors whatsoever in the emergency department. Then things loosened up a little bit where visitors could come in if they didn't have symptoms and they were masked. And then we got to a point where it was just, you only had to wear a mask in patient rooms. And now we're at a point where it's optional, you know. Oh, if I go into a room and someone's coughing up a lung, maybe, I'll probably put on a mask. It makes sense, right? Yeah. But if I go in and you're here because you broke your arm, I don't see a reason to wear a mask. Yeah. You know, yeah. I do think that there is some benefit to exposing yourself to stuff, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's how we develop immunity. If you live in a bubble, then anything will kill you when you come out of it, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
Well, plus, you know, we learn more about, hey, at first it was everybody. Then it was like, well, wait a second. There's people with pre-existing conditions of a certain sort, people of a certain age, yada, 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 all that stuff. That, like, okay, this makes people more vulnerable. And there was, and it seemed like, and at least from my experience, it seemed like on both sides, there was just so little room for people in the know to be sitting down and rather than just taking a position, to sit down and try and puzzle this out in a way. Well, geez, maybe not everybody's got to get dressed up like
that. There was not great dialogue.
No, it's terrible.
There wasn't great. I feel like there was not great dialogue. It was, everyone was just so hard stance on one side, like, mask at all times. This is the end of the world. This is going to kill you. And other people's like, no mask. We need to expose ourselves. This is just the flu. And I feel like they should have found a way to meet in the middle. But I think because of how highly politicized it became, and also just, you know, in medicine, a lot of folks, because they have so much passion for their work and how much they love caring for people, it's hard for them to say anything aside from the most protective and maternal or paternal standpoint, which is to wrap you in a bubble and keep you safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Get it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is switching gears or not, but did your experience in the military and thereafter, or growing up and maybe even now living through that COVID piece, did it push you in a direction? Like, do you find yourself like, are you a more conservative person than a lot of the people you bump into? Are you, you know, the camps, right? And the conservative, liberal, whatever.
sure.
Do you like, when you went through the military, your commander in chief is your commander in chief. And I think a lot of people have the impression that people in the military are, you know, unless you know not a bunch of them, that people in the military are, well, certainly when they're in there, that's the commander in chief. Yeah, that's right. But I don't necessarily have to agree with that person, but right, but there are, or as a chain of command, et cetera. Did you find yourself being pushed in a particular direction, more conservative, more aligned with that world?
Or... Sure. Yeah, you know, I think the military definitely pushed me a little bit more to the, you know, a little more to the conservative side. But then my medical training, you know, going to medical school in, you know, UC San Francisco definitely kind of yanked me in the other direction. So I try not to label myself because I think I have viewpoints that kind of sit on both sides there. And I kind of just take things, you know, topic by topic and question by question and do it that way. I don't think it makes sense to just pick a side and then completely align with everything that they say.
Yeah.
With all those policymakers or whatever, you know, it just makes no sense. And you're a robot. You're not a free thinker. And I'd rather be a free thinker. So.
Okay. Well, what do you think about what's going on? So all these kids on campuses protesting that the college needs, at least in most cases, the college needs to divest any investments, et cetera, distance itself from Israel, et cetera, all that. Does that push your former Marine? Well, you're never really a former Marine. No one's ever a former Marine. But does that push your Marine identity in one direction or another, or not?
I don't think so. I think that these students have the rights to free speech completely. They don't have the right to, you know, batter and break down campuses. They don't have the right to obstruct students from going to do their, you know, day-to-day lives and go to school and go to commencement, but they should be heard. You know, I think the problem with it is a lot of these students don't know really what they're fighting for or their cause. If you look, I mean, a lot of them, you can go ask them questions. So, you know, what do you know about Palestine? You know, what do you know about all these things? What do you know about the Gaza Strip and everything? And a lot of them don't know. It's just, I think a lot of our youth nowadays need identity. And sometimes they dive into these things just to feel a sense of belonging, you know?
Yeah.
And I know because I had that sense before I joined the Marine Corps. I know exactly what that's like. You know, that was kind of my protest initially, right? That was my way of finding community and finding some sense of belonging. I think that, you know, I think that what's going on in over there, it's a very challenging situation. You know, I don't like the loss of any innocent life. And I think if people want to protest that, they should be able to, but it needs to be done appropriately.
Well, here's something. So you're 37, is that what you said? You're 37.
Mm-hmm.
You got a lot of things under your belt. You've clearly got an inclination to work at things that benefit others, right? Military service, medical medicine, you know, the choice you even make within medicine, even then, choices you make, you know, you decide to go to some place where you feel like you can help people who have less padding between them and the concrete when they fall. And so do you think of yourself? No, I don't even know how to ask this question. I guess what I'm wondering is, you would be a perfect role model for young people. Like, you know, hey, look, this is a person who's making choices, conscious choices, in the direction of benefiting others. Not that thus there's no benefit to you and all that, but
sure.
So should you be a role model? Do you see yourself as a role model?
I try to
that to you, does it make you nervous? Like, hey, wait a minute. No, I'm not a role model.
No, I mean, I try to live my life every day as if there was someone looking at me as a role model. You know, that's kind of one of the things that helps guide my actions. Yeah, I mean, I've tried to be a good role model. You know, I've got a family that I try to be a good role model to. I've given talks to minorities in medicine. I've talked to military recruits, and you know, I have students that I help teach often, and I try to be a good role model to them. So, you know, I think it's a good thing for an adult to be a role model, because it really helps kind of push you and guide you in the right direction, even growing. You know, being a role model actually makes you better. So.
Yeah,
that's something I sure strive to be.
Sure. Yeah. What do you, if so? Given that, if you were a role model, what do you hope people get from you?
Oh, interesting.
You know, well, I'm I mean, a role I would, model, so I want them to walk away with something. What's that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is that, you know, most of our boundaries in life are self-proposed. You know, we set our own limits often. You know, I told myself when I was a kid I couldn't be a doctor, and look where I am now, right? I think a lot of those limits we put on ourselves, which we shouldn't. You should shoot for the stars and land where you do, you know? I think be brave and, you know, speak up. Speak up when you need to or when you feel is the right thing to do. Be loyal and be honest to people. You know, I think that's really big for me. I think honesty and loyalty are huge. Your word is all you have many times, you know, and once you lose someone's trust, it's very hard to earn that back.
You bet.
And, you know, keep your family close, because you only get one. So yeah. Mine mean the world to me.
Yeah, that's great. That's wonderful. And is there a next? I mean, you're somebody who, like, from the outside looking in, you know, when you tell your story, when you tell your story organically, well, okay, it makes sense. You know, you were a kid, you wanted to be a doctor. You didn't quite have the discipline. You made a choice to put yourself in a place that maybe you could develop that. You did that. It's like, but you're also from the outside looking in, like, well, this is a guy who challenges himself, right? You know, I'm gonna join you. I'm going to join the Marines. I'm going to go to, I think I should go back to school. No. I'm going to go to medical school. It's so, and then I'm going to be an emergency doctor. And then, so
sure. Is
there a next? I mean, are you like in the back of your mind is like, I think I want to be a cop or whatever it is. It's like, is there a next hurdle?
Yeah, interesting. You know, I mean, there are other things I'm already doing now. You know, my buddy and I, we help train law enforcement and paramedic tactical medicine, or we help kind of teach them how to stay alive in tough situations and how to treat patients when you're under duress. So that's one thing I'm doing. I also help as a medical director for an event medicine company. So I run medical at a lot of music festivals, which is really challenging because, you know, you never know what you're going to see there, especially with overdoses and everything.
Yes, you do.
Yes, fair. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
You don't have a particular manifestation, but you know it's there.
That's fair. Yeah. But I do think that there is a next. You know, I remember one of my staff sergeants told me once that complacency kills. And I totally believe that. I think if I sit here and I sit, start getting a little stagnant in the waters and just waking up and going to work and doing the same thing every day, then I'm just going to lose the wind in my sails.
Yeah.
So I do think there is a next. You know, I'm actively looking for something. I had a lot of thoughts about going into urban search and rescue through some of these FEMA teams here and trying to get on a team and do that. I've already done some of the training. I think that would be a fun thing, and kind of dive into that vein of spontaneity and challenge that I like, because you never know when you're going to get called to go help out. So there's definitely a next. This is not the final chapter.
Yeah, that's super interesting. It's thinking about having this conversation with you. That was what I wanted the response to be. It was like, this is a guy who is doing that and in such a good direction. Really, it's not necessarily, I mean, I don't care. I don't know how much money you have, but you're not motivated. That's not what you brought up. It's not like, you know, I want to make $1 billion before I'm 30. It's not like that. So good for you.
Yeah.
I mean, what a pleasure. So
thank you.
So if we stopped this conversation, what would you be disappointed that we hadn't spoken about or that you hadn't had an opportunity to say?
Wow, that's a good question. Wow. I hadn't thought about it. This is a good conversation. That is a good question. What would I wish I had spoken more about? I don't know. That's tough.
I mean, maybe we've done it, but sometimes, sometimes afterwards, like, oh God, you know, I mean, I had this experience with actually Zach Stad, who at the very end of our conversation, really, he said, oh, I forgot to, whatever, and turned it back on and did part two.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, I thought my experience in that COVID unit was really interesting. When I was working with Team Rubicon, when I was in my last year of residency, when COVID was, you know, was obviously going pretty strong, there were a lot of homeless folks who were catching COVID, and our hospitals didn't really, we just couldn't take everybody. And when they were, semi-stable enough to be discharged, but didn't have anywhere to discharge them, we had to figure out something to do. So Team Rubicon stepped in, which they do a lot of disaster relief. And they took over the Santa Clara Convention Center, and they just put a ton of cots in there and some medical supplies. And I reached out, and I actually ended up running that unit for quite some time. So during the daytime, and I was just a medical resident, which I thought was fascinating. But, you know, during the daytime, I'd be in the hospital working. And then at night, I would go there and I'd round on all the patients, check on them, get their vital signs.
And it was entirely COVID. It was entirely a COVID.
Only COVID.
Distressed only population.
COVID. And I remember I'd go in there and just, you know, and just sit with them and talk to them. And we'd sometimes even play cards. And I found it so interesting. It was like another, I learned so much more about medicine and so much more about how you even evaluate people. You know, just having conversations with them, seeing from the beginning how they'd speak in 3-4-word sentences to the 10th day, we'd be having full conversations. They're breathing normally. They're acting normal. You can see so much with that. You didn't need a pulse oximeter. You didn't need your stethoscope. You didn't need all that, even though we had a lot of that stuff. Just by sitting there and having a conversation at a table with them, we were able to one, like, liven their spirits, but to also see how well they were doing. And it was tough. I was tired as hell all the time. I was sleeping on a cot. At times, there was a couple of times where I just grabbed a big orange trash bag and wrapped that around myself as a blanket. Fortunately, I produced a lot of body heat.
Do you think that experience, you have any insight into how that experience may have affected how you are a doctor now?
I think so. I mean, one, just seeing the appreciation that population had for us. You know, a lot of it's tough. You know, we get a lot of homeless patients in emergency departments, and sometimes they just want to get out of the cold, and sometimes they just want a sandwich, and some folks get, irritated at that or upset. And for me, especially having sat there and talked to them and get to know them and hear their stories, I have a lot more respect and love for that population. You know, a lot of people think that a lot of homeless people are crazy, but what we don't realize is a lot of people actually with mental illness become homeless because of that mental illness and getting, just pushed away from society and their circle and kind of losing their work. So it helped me become definitely more loving towards that population, but it also helped, again, kind of show me that I can handle. One, it helped me show that I was ready to become an attending. You know, I was seeing over there 50, 60 patients on my own at night. And it just showed me that one of those challenges, where I put myself in a situation to show myself that I'd be able to do it. And fortunately we did, everyone turned out okay. But I love that experience. Definitely.
But, that was toward the end of your residency when COVID was full blown. Yeah.
It was my last year residency.
And so you would work. So you were in residency, you'd work all day, and then
I'd go there at night. Yeah. I'd check on everyone. I'd do my rounds, and then I would just lay on a cot and get some sleep and then go into work in the morning. It sounds crazy, but sometimes when you're doing something that means a lot to you like that, the sleep doesn't make as much of a difference. You know, getting a few hours, I was still amped. I was like, I'm playing a role. I'm helping people. Like that's what fuels my fire, is helping others and you know, just putting the smile on someone else's face, even though sometimes it takes me telling a really stupid joke, but I'll do it. You know, I just making other people happy and feel better fuels my fire. So I loved it, you know.
Oh, cool. Well, that is a perfect way to end the conversation. That is really, so owner Yenigan, what a nice guy. I wish I had more time. Well, now I know where you live, right? So
yeah, you building. Sure do.
So
that's true. You really do though.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what a pleasure. What a pleasure it is.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.